having completed the three stages of ascent of the soul, namely the physical, the vital, and the mental, we have now come in our discussion at the stage of transition, a radical transition from the lower triple existence into the higher belt of a diviner existence. As we observed earlier, between the lower triple existence and the higher triple existence of existence, consciousness and bliss, there is the link world, the world of truth knowledge. To ascend into it marks a radical departure from our lower nature, human nature, into a divine nature. All that has gone before changes its character. What happens hereafter cannot be compared with what has gone before. Even the highest heights of the mind cannot give an idea of the realms that are beyond the mind. Sri Aurobindo observes that the topmost summits of the mind, including the overmind, still labor under the mighty shadow of ignorance, the shadow of division. It is only after you register an ascent beyond the over-mental levels and enter into the region of the truth mind, truth knowledge, that you are at last freed from the pursuing taint of ignorance and division. This principle, the principle of the soul's poise here, the universal soul's poise, along with its nature, characteristic nature, is called the vijnana. In Sanskrit, the vijnana means knowledge par excellence. It is not to be identified with the term of the same name in Buddhist philosophy, where it means discriminative reason, intelligence, pure intelligence, reason. The vijnana is something else. The whole principle is different. Nor is it to be confused with the conception based indeed upon spiritual experience in the Vedanta, which speaks of a masked, illumined consciousness. It is called Chaitanya Ghana or Chit Ghana in the Upanishads, whereby they mean a luminous consciousness masked around one idea, one truth of oneness. It does not admit in its fold the truth of multiplicity. Neither of these constitute the truth of vijnana. Keeping this in mind, it is profitable to compare the workings of the mind, including its farthest ranges, with the workings and the functionings of the vijnana, which we shall call for our purpose the principle of truth knowledge. The mind seeks for knowledge. The mind depends largely upon the report of the senses. Mind itself is called the sixth sense. The five senses pursue the objects, alight upon them, bring back the report and submit it to the presiding mind. The mind bases itself upon the percepts of the senses and arrives at its own concepts. Through this interweaving of percepts and percepts of the senses and concepts of idea of the reason, the mind arrives at a certain knowledge. After arriving at that knowledge, it compares its knowledge with other knowledges similarly arrived at. It draws upon memory. It draws upon inference, analyzes, synthesizes, judges. With all these processes, it arrives at something like a knowledge which at its best is a tentative knowledge. Knowledge of today is always replaceable when a larger knowledge dawns tomorrow. But the way of the truth mind, the truth knowledge, is quite different. There, it does not seek for knowledge from outside. It is one with the object of knowledge. Whatever it chooses to know, this truth mind knows by a sort of identity. Just as I know that I am so and so, I know what is happening in me. When I feel joy, I know. When I feel anger, I know. Similarly, by an equally authentic and valid experience, this truth mind knows everything that it chooses to know. It does not have to infer, it does not have to draw upon a past memory. All knowledge stands mapped out to its vision. The knowledge of the vijnana is one of self-vision. There is a vision which widens itself, elongates itself as the need may be. And the knowledge is delivered without having to reason. Some distant idea of the working of this faculty can be got by the working of what is called intuition. Normally, what we call intuition is not intuition at all, but a vague and a weak reflection. Man is normally accustomed to work his reason, logical reason, and arrive at a result, conclusion. At times what happens, with the rapid turning of the intelligence, the intellect leaps certain steps and arrives at a conclusion with a certain certainty about it, and that we call intuition. What has happened is only a precipitation of the working of the laboring reason. When one traces back sincerely, conscientiously, one can know which are the steps which have been leaped over. This is not intuition, but it is a pale imitation of intuition. A truer idea of what the intuition is can be got by an observation of what is called instinct at the animal level. Animals we have seen, which do not have reasoning, they guide themselves instinctively. They desist from eating certain leaves. They hesitate to place their feet in certain areas, and so on. When there is danger, they instinctively feel the sense presence of danger. This faculty is an expression of the original intuition at the animal level in a form that suits the development of that consciousness. This is interfered with when the vital mind, the reasoning mind, steps in. The true intuition goes straight to the solution. It is only afterwards that we can verify. And when it comes, there is such a sense of self-evident authenticity about it that there can be no mistake. But even such an intuition, pure intuition, is not a direct working of the truth mind or the supramental consciousness. It is only what Sri Aurobindo calls an edge. Intuition is an edge of a light ray proceeding from the light of the gnosis. For our purpose, vijnana, truth knowledge, the supramental and the gnosis are the same. When a proper intuition works, the mind, human mind, rushes and mixes up its own stuff with that pure intuition, so that ultimately what we have, even in the intuition, is pure enough. It is origin, it is a mixed and a pseudo intuition. To be free from this intrusion, Sri Aurobindo points out that we have to take care to keep out the mixture of the physical mentality, which always depends for its knowledge upon appearances, upon the vital mentality, which is governed largely by desires, emotions, passions, preferences. And also thirdly, to keep out the workings of the limited mind, which is always governed by its pet notions, prejudices, likes and dislikes. Now all these three are distorting elements which insist on mixing themselves with the advent of the intuitive light. These three are, Sri Aurobindo recalls, the three knots which are referred in an ancient Vedic hymn. The three knots which are loosened, which have to be loosened by invoking the grace of the Supreme. To that we will come at the end of our discussion. Now, after assuring ourselves that there is no more intrusion of these lower workings of the mind, of the pseudo workings of quoted intuition. One essence in consciousness. One has to cross through levels after levels. The level of illumination, the level of inspiration, the level of intuition, before we are admitted into the realm of the Gnosis. The Gnosis, the world of light, the world of truth power. The first characteristic, distinguishing characteristic of this principle is that knowledge is invariably accompanied by power. It does not happen here as it happens on other lower levels, that there is the idea, but the idea cannot effectuate itself for want of a supporting power. Here, truth reveals itself as knowledge, and that knowledge carries its own self-effectuating power. This, it is not even a combination. It is a double principle of knowledge and power. To put it in other words, it's creative truth. The ancients had a way of speaking in picturesque symbols. They speak of this vijnana, this principle, as the sun of truth, the glorious sun of truth, of whom the physical sun on our planet is a symbol, only a symbol. This sun they called the eye of the gods, because the functioning is through vision. Whoever reaches or attains that level sees with that vision, not with that borrowed light passing through our physical organ of the eye, which can be deformed by any defect in the instrument. It is a self-seeing eye of light. It is also called the creator or the manifester of the universe, because the truth that shines through the sun of truth is creative. That is why he is called the creative sun, the releaser, the manifester, the creator. On the highest levels, even of the overmind, one only gets the rays of this supramental sun. One does not live directly in the light. And as you know, the principle of the overmental creation is multiplicity, though based upon unity. Each one pursues its independent career, and there are three stages of which Sri Aurobindo speaks before we can rise to our full stature in the Gnosis. First, what he calls the marshalling of the rays, R-A-Y-S. There is the sun. His million rays are extended. The seeker, as he ascends, he prays to the Godhead to help him to marshal the rays. There are so many thoughts, so many ideas, so many truths that are visible. They all have to be brought together in the order of their relation, arranged in a order, in the order of the truth. That is the first step. After they are marshalled, arranged, they are to be gathered together and fused in the sun, in the body of the sun. Once all these multiplicities and diversities, which are signified by the rays of the sun, are unified, are fused in the body of the luminous orb, the truth reveals itself. That is the goodliest form of all, the fairest form of thee, where all is seen in the orb of the creative truth, all as manifestations of the One. And the climax comes that the person in the sun is none other than I. He am I. This is the great cry of the Upanishad. The marvelous discovery of the seer when he realizes at the end of his journey to the truth world that not only is the whole universe contained in the truth that he sees, but he realizes that he and that truth are one. Himself, the world, and the creative person, all are one. This is the climactic experience of ascent into the Gnosis. I spoke of the Vedic parable in which there is reference to the three knots. It was written at least 5,000 years ago, it is recorded in a legend, and a legend in the past traditions always clothed some significant truths. The story goes that there was a king and he had no son, nobody to succeed him to the throne. So he prayed to God, to one god, Varuna, the god of vastness, the god of purity, the god presiding over the ocean. He prayed to him for a son. And when he prayed, he said, "Give me progeny, and the first son I will sacrifice to you." The god was obliging, and he did get a son. But the king conveniently forgot his promise. But the god would not let him forget. He afflicted him with dropsy. So when the king was afflicted with dropsy, the story got round, and the boy, he was a young boy, hardly 10 or 12, he came to know the whole story, and he knew that his father would then take him to be sacrificed. So without his father's knowledge, he ran away to the forest. And there, in the course of his wanderings, he came across a poor couple who were starving, who had a son. He struck a bargain with them that their son, called Shunashepa, they would give the son in exchange for 100 head of cattle. The bargain was struck. The young boy, younger than this prince, he was brought to the palace. The cattle were given in exchange. And a huge ceremony started with Shunashepa tied to the stake in three places, three strings, top, middle and bottom. When the ceremony was in progress, when hymns were being recited to propitiate the deity, one sage took pity on him and told him to invoke that very deity with particular hymns. And the story is that he went on invoking in 15 verses, praying to that God. And the most significant verse was, he told him, "You release me from these three knots so that I may once again look on the face of my mother, the infinite." Western scholars and Indian students following them interpret this hymn as an evidence of human sacrifice. As usual, they are far wide of the mark. This is a parable of the human soul tied to the stake of ignorance. The word shunashepa, in its derivative sense, means a ray of delight. The human soul issues from the creative delight of the Supreme. Each soul is a ray of bliss. Here, in this field of ignorance, in this world of ignorance, it has been enveloped by darkness, obscurity, and it is triply bound to the lower nature. There is a lowermost bondage to the physical bondage, the middle, the bondage to the vitality, passions, ambitions, desires and such like, bondage in the mind, the mental bondage. So these are the three bondages that the human soul wants to be delivered of with the aid of the grace of God, so that it can look again on the face of its mother, who is the infinite Aditi, the mother of the gods, the mother of all. Aditi, whom Sri Aurobindo describes as the vast infinite taking a form. This is the parable of the human soul. Even before one is admitted to the sanctum of the truth mind, these three knots must be dissolved. What mother calls the triple ego, the ego of the physical, the ego of the vital, and the most difficult, the ego of the mental. Unless these three knots are resolved, the Veda does not speak of cutting the knots, of unloosening, untying the knots, very much in the line of mother's thought. She doesn't believe in surgical methods, but in unloosening, untying the knots. This Vedic parable is repeated in the life of each and every individual at some stage or other in the course of his evolutionary journey to the spirit. Just as the legendary crucifixion of Christ is repeated in each individual case before man is admitted into the penetralia of the divine. Similarly, the resolution of the three bonds in the hall of death Any questions?
Could you say a little more about the meaning of the name Sunasheka?
Ray of bliss. Ray.
Of human delight or divine delight?
Divine. Bliss, capital. Of which human joy is a deformation. Difference between?
Yeah. Between, you said cutting knots and...
Yes, 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 yes. The knots in lower nature, they have formed in the course, long course of evolution, due to involvement in ignorance and obscurity, and the fact of our being rooted in inconscience. So this has developed certain convolutions and knots. The old Indian, not the ancient, but the medieval Indian way and the way of ascetic disciplines all over the world was to make a radical decision to cut off the offending parts, to leave out those parts which are under knots, which refuse to march along. So from the soul, from the central being, a decision was made and they were just psychologically cut off. They were no more allowed to participate in the journey. Now the Vedic way, the mothers and Sri Aurobindo's way is not to shut out any part, not to cut out any section, but to patiently loosen the knots that have formed down the centuries and reset the working. Place each part in its proper place. The proper placement of emotions, of parts, of thoughts, of ideas. At present they are all displaced and in wrong places. For them to be gathered up and put it in the proper functionings, that is the unloosening of the knots and reforming the personality. Nothing is to be excised, nothing is to be cut out, all is to be gathered up, released from the clamps and promoted to play their respective parts in the journey to the divine. It is easy enough to renounce. To leave out certain parts which are difficult and go ahead with only a little part which is awakened, which is not too much involved. Thereby man forfeits the trust placed in him by the Creator, all-wise Creator.
How can the experiences of human delight, human love, be transformed in daily life experiences to those of divine love and divine delight?
There is some element common between divine love and human love. There is some element which is common. That element is to be extended, enlarged. Ignore the other elements, but deepen and cultivate that particular element which it has in common with the higher love. For instance, the element in love, human love, which expresses itself in self-giving. The question of demand in human love comes later, but the first step is to give oneself. Maybe between a man and a woman, between a mother and her son, child. It is a self-giving. This first step of self-giving is a divine movement. The whole human course of development is against it. Aggrandizement, ego, self-taking is the root. But it is when the love begins to manifest that the first movement to give oneself. It may be a motivated love, but the fact remains that one gives oneself. Mother says, catch hold of that hook. Eliminate the impure elements like motive, like a demand, like a claim following the expression of love. They are the human vitiating elements. Separate them. Go on deepening and enlarging the area of pure love. As you go on doing it, you will begin to touch the fringe of divine love. Thereafter, a stage will come when the person on whom you center your love, that person just disappears. That power of love, that faculty of expressing in self-giving, it extends itself spontaneously to all around. The person who was the cause of your first exercising that faculty is no more than an excuse. Human love, individual love, acquires the character of universal love. One step more and you stumble into the divine love. Love is a power. If only you will allow it to grow without making it a prisoner of the vital, it draws out the soul from its depths. It brings out the best in you, the nobility of the soul, the stature of man, human stature. That a man or a woman can do things, sacrifice, give herself, himself, without expecting anything in return. That is the decisive moment that links human love to the divine. If because human love has been associated with the lower vital, you are to reject love, the heart, mother worms, will turn into a place, into a dry stone. Even when the divine comes, you will be unable to respond in love. You may intellectually, mentally conceive, receive, but the heart will be dead. Heart is a God-given place for the cultivation of love. At the level where you are, start. Love for an animal, love for an idol, icon, love for a person, but love. It is love with the hoop of gods for hearts to combine. Rishi Aurobindo says somewhere in Eric. It is man's lien on the absolute. If man, through love, we have lay our claim on the divine. The origin of all creation has been love. The glorious culmination also will be in the blossoming of love. When the supramental consciousness organizes itself fully on earth, the characteristic atmosphere will be one of love, pure love, and there is nothing that love cannot achieve. That's why the mother says, love is the greatest power. Our image of it may be deformed, may be diminished, but the truth remains. He simply said, I think, of the overhead planes. He speaks of overhead planes, and in a passage or two he says there are certain passages of overmental inspiration. But I don't remember his saying anywhere or speaking of any passage as coming from the supramental inspiration. We'll have to develop that sense to recognize that inspiration. Till then, for us, all are overhead inspirations.
Christ talked about a personal, individual, rather, divine life. And in that sense, he is somewhat like this teacher. Do you feel that, have you heard Sri Aurobindo say that Christ, one particular plane he might have been on, so that he would have some knowledge possibly of this kind of thing, the kingdom of heaven, to be related to this?
If we take it that the truth that Christ came to manifest or establish on earth is the truth of love, it cannot be classified in terms of these planes, because the source of love is not in the vertical order, but in the psychic, behind the whole thing. So there is love on every plane. There are certain manifestations which cannot be evaluated in terms of planes. When they derive from the soul, like delight, like love, they are present on each plane. So all that we can say is, he was a spiritual consciousness. He came to manifest spiritual love, and much more than love, to establish the fact of grace. That the divine grace can alone save man. No.
Explain this particular thing, wasn't it? But he must have had some kind of knowledge that it would ultimately be.
Need not. One incarnation generally does not have or does not care to have a foreknowledge of what the next incarnation is going to do. An incarnation comes with a mission, with a special truth to manifest. It does it and withdraws. They are not evolutionary beings like us.